Today is Wednesday, September 20th. We're going to wrap up Chapter 4 with membranes and start Chapter 5 with skin.
All right, so thinking about membranes on page 51, let's go back and talk about the organizational scheme of the human body. We know that the building block of life is a cell, and cells of similar types form what?
Tissues,
good. Tissues that work together for a common function are now called?
Organs.
Okay, so let me stop there, because when you think about the definition for a membrane is in fact an organ. That means it contains two different tissue types working together for a common function. Okay, so that's why they're wedged in here after your tissues and before we start our first organ system. There's two major categories of membranes we're going to cover. We're going to talk about epithelial membranes first and then connective membranes. And, you know, there's not a whole lot to memorize here because the name tells you what type of tissue is common. So epithelial membranes do include epithelial tissue, but they also contain some connective tissue. By contrast, what do you think connective membranes contain? Connective tissue, yeah. So use the name to guide you into understanding what type of tissue is found in there. Let's go back and review. Of these two tissue types, epithelial and connective, which one binds, protects, connects?
Connective,
good. So that's what that type of membrane is going to do. And what is a job for epithelial tissues? Cover, line? What's that?
Insulating.
Yeah, so we're looking at those kinds of jobs going for our epithelial membranes. So we don't want to lose sight of something we've already learned. We're already familiar with what epithelial tissues and connective tissues do. Okay, so let me talk to you about the epithelial membranes first. There are three types here. We have the dry cutaneous membranes. We have moist mucous membranes and another moist membrane called serous membrane. So let's take those cutaneous membranes first. First things first, what do you recognize here?
Skin.
Yep. And what is the topmost region called?
Apical surface.
Yeah, apical surface, and you're right, that is epidermis. And the deeper tissue is?
Dermis,
good. What type of epithelial tissue makes up your epidermis? Squamous, good. Simple or stratified?
Stratified.
And down below in the dermis, what does this look like to you? Connective tissue, good. This is mostly dense, irregular. There's some loose areolar here, but you know, we're getting a feel of stratified squamous over dense, irregular connective tissue. This is a dry membrane. You know, you can of course touch your skin, it is dry, compared to the lining inside your mouth, which is moist. So what is it about this tissue that makes it a dry membrane?
Keratin,
good. So keratin is what makes this a dry and waterproofed membrane. And on your worksheet, let's talk about keratin a little bit more. Keratin is in fact a waterproofing protein. It's a tough fibrous protein. It is made by cells called keratinocytes in your epidermis, and its job is to waterproof your outermost region of skin. So in this picture, you can see a thin outer covering, and that is the dried out keratin. You may want to put a star beside this one or highlight where it says this is an unusual membrane because it's dry. Out of all of our membranes, this is the only dry membrane. This is the only dry membrane.
Cutaneous.
Yeah.
Keratin makes it dry.
Yeah. So thanks to keratin, we can have a shower and not gain weight. Or, God, how awful would that be? You get in the shower, you gain 10 pounds. Or worse yet, you go into a swimming pool, you're fully immersed and gain more weight than that. We also can go into an ocean and not shrivel up like little prunes because of keratin. just an interesting tidbit of information. You know, if you soak in a tub for too long, your fingers look what we call shrimpy. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are uneven keratin deposits on your hands and your fingers. So where keratin is present, you don't get that shrimpy look. But where the keratin's been rubbed thinner, you actually get more of a shriveled and a prunish look to those fingers. So kind of a cool thing. That's actually evidence that keratin should be doing its job, you know, keeping you waterproof. You know, there's a point where you know too much trivia. That's really the point, isn't it? Okay, let's talk about mucous membranes. They're next. So I want to make a point about the spelling here. I know we're all about spelling in Bio 210, right? When you're talking about mucous membranes, you spell it with an O, and that represents the membrane that secretes the mucus. But if you're talking about the rubbery, sticky substance secreted by mucous membranes, the actual rubbery stuff is spelled without the O. So I don't know why they did that. That just makes it more confusing. But I wanted you to know that there's not misspellings. There's actually a difference in why they spell it with or without the O. Crazy stuff, right? Make my life easier and just spell it the same way, you know? This should look familiar. This is another epithelial membrane. What we tend to see here are epithelial tissues on top of a layer of connective tissue. And up here we've got non-keratinized epithelium. In fact, all of this is epithelial tissue. It is stratified squamous once again, and it's sitting on top of a, looks like a dense irregular connective tissue. Okay, so the fact that this is non-keratinized tells me something. Is this a dry membrane?
No.
Not dry. So how would this one feel?
Moist.
Moist, good. Thinking about your body, you know, when we eat food, it abrades and wears away the lining inside our mouth. This is what the inside of your mouth has, is non-keratinized stratified squamous sitting on top of a connective tissue layer. Well, what comes in has to go out the other end, right? So the anal region also has stratified squamous made up of non-keratinized epithelial tissues. I don't think I need to tell you how painful it would be to have a bowel movement with a dry rectum and a dry anus. So there is a reason that there is non-keratinized moist mucous membrane in those locations. So we need that mucus to help lubricate along the passage of things like food coming through our digestive tract. This is also a moist mucous membrane. This is simple columnar sitting on top of a connective tissue. Looks like it's probably loose areolar. So where might you find simple columnar in the digestive tract? Stomach, small intestine, and even large intestine, yeah. So there are special cells embedded in this simple columnar tissue. They're called?
Goblet cells,
yeah. What do goblet cells release?
Mucus,
right, the word without the O. Okay, so moist mucus comes from these goblet cells, and the function is to lubricate the passage of food. Okay, that's a blank there for you. The function of mucus is to lubricate. What else?
Trap microbes.
Trap microbes, good. Good, so mucus is great for lubrication, trapping microbes. Anything else? That's a pretty good list. Okay. So we often think about having mucus in our nasal cavities, and that would be, of course, a moist mucous membrane inside your nasal cavity. And we often think about the mucus in there trapping bacteria. And it kind of sounds weird to think about mucus in your stomach or your digestive tract, but it's actually that mucus that keeps your acid in your stomach from digesting away your stomach lining. And when we get into the intestines, that mucus helps to move food along. Food's only going to spend about 3 to 6 hours in your small intestine, and there's 20 feet of small intestine to travel over. So, yeah, that's a lot of, that's a breakneck speed you're going through, right?
So is everybody has 20 feet of that?
Everybody has 20 feet of, about 25 feet total of intestine, yeah. 20 of small and 5 of large. But that measurement's taken in a cadaver where there's no muscle tone. In a living human, because we have muscle tone, it is accordioned up. So that's a lot of height.
That's probably take, when they take it out, like you have people do surgery, sometimes they take their insides up and they can't put it all back in.
That's right, because when they rearrange it, it never goes back right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. These are villi. It's a very low magnification. I think they look like Christmas trees. But on each one of these, you actually have simple columnar epithelial tissue. And we know that simple columnar is great for doing what? Absorb. Yeah, absorption. Yeah, absorption and secretion. So we're secreting mucus at this location, and we're also absorbing nutrients. So we're now starting to make more sense out of all of these different tissue types. This one is not serous, it's just a serous membrane. And these are found around the outsides of the organs in your ventral body cavity. On which side of your body is your ventral body cavity?
Front
side, good. You have two subdivisions to your ventral body cavity. The one that contains heart and lungs is called?
Thoracic,
good. The one that includes digestive organs?
Abdominopelvic,
that's right. So these organs in your ventral body cavity are the only ones that have serous membranes. These membranes are not on the inside surface of the organ, rather they are on the outside surface of the organ. So it's like taking your heart, dropping it into a Ziploc bag, and filling the bag with just a little bit of fluid. The purpose of having that fluid is, guess what? Reducing friction, because those organs rub up against each other, exactly. So we've actually got two layers to your typical serous membrane. They are paper-thin, simple squamous epithelial layers, and we have an innermost layer that covers the organ. Is that innermost layer your visceral or your parietal layer?
Visceral.
Visceral. And there's a great way to remember that. What does viscera mean? Viscera means organ. Okay, so viscera means organ. That's a great way to remember. The visceral layer contacts the organ. Contrast, that parietal layer is the outermost of the two layers. It may, in fact, make contact with the body wall. So your thoracic cavity wall or your abdominopelvic cavity wall is going to be contacted by that parietal layer. These two layers, though, stick together. And what's between them is a type of fluid called serous fluid. And what do you think the function of this fluid is?
Reduce friction.
Good. I'll give you a moment to jot down that in the blank. The function of serous fluid is to reduce friction around organs. Function of serous fluid is to reduce friction around organs. So let me give you an example of why these two layers stick together. If you've ever had a glass of cold water or iced tea in the summertime, and you sit your glass on a table, if you go back about 20 or 30 minutes later and you try to pick up your glass, it has sweated condensation all over the table, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you've got a glass, not a paper cup or a plastic cup, and you lift directly up, you'll notice there's a little bit of a seal created between the cup and the table. That is water and its cohesiveness. It's sticking together, and it's also adhering to the table. If you kind of break the seal and move your glass to the side, you can lift that cup directly up. These two layers stick the same way. Because serous fluid is made mostly of water, those two layers are going to stick together. And that's great because we need those layers to stay together. that's going to drive things like respiration when we get into bio 211. All right, so let me take you over to top of the next page. That's 52. Let's talk about three specific types of serous membranes. Of serous membrane is a pericardium. What organ does it cover?
Heart.
It covers the heart. Good. Because we're talking about a covering for the heart, we call it peri or around. Card is heart. And of course, there's a visceral and parietal layer, as we find with all of our serous membranes. The innermost layer that contacts your heart muscle tissue is called the visceral pericardium. What separates your visceral pericardium from the parietal pericardium?
Serous fluid.
Serous fluid, good. Really thin layer, but it's enough to keep those two layers stuck to each other. And then, of course, that thin layer is also helping to lubricate around your heart. So you can see kind of an analogy here to punching your fist into a balloon. You can see how the portion that covers your fist would be the visceral layer, and the outermost portion would be your parietal layer. This is another set of membranes. These are the peritoneum. What organs do they cover?
Digestive
organs, good. And again, the visceral layer contacts what? The organ, good. The visceral layer contacts the organ. Parietal layer is the outermost of the two. Then going back up to your pleura, they cover which organs? The lungs. Good. If you watch TV, you've probably seen these commercials for mesothelioma, and they say contact your lawyer if you work in asbestos series. And you're thinking, what the heck's mesothelioma? Well, it's actually a cancer of cells that occur between their serous membranes. And apparently when asbestos gets into your body, it aggravates and causes cancer cells to grow in between those serous membranes. So it's actually on the outside of the lungs, not the inside of the lungs, that's affected. So, you know, that's just the nature of that particular cancer. It's not like traditional lung cancer that affects the other lung tissues that come from smoking. This particular type of lung cancer is coming from asbestos exposure. So, all right. So you can see in the thoracic cavity, there's a lot of organs packed in here. There's not a lot of space. And it makes sense as to why we need a lubricating serous membrane around the outsides of those organs. So I want to emphasize again, these serous membranes cover the outside of your organ. They're not found in the inner linings. We would have moist mucous membranes on the inside, not necessarily serous membranes. They're on the outside covering. Do you have questions so far about our three types of epithelial membranes? So here's something for us to think about. You're looking at a picture of the heart. They're showing us the pericardium. Is letter A your visceral or parietal?
Parietal.
Right. How do you know? It's outside, right? It's been peeled back. And of course, letter B looks like it's anchored directly to the heart itself. Kind of a cool picture because you can see right through here there's a space, and that's a space that we call the pericardial sac. And that's where the serous fluid would circulate around the outside of the heart. You know, crazy stuff. People can get a pneumonia, case of pneumonia in the lungs, and that pneumonia can actually travel over and cause pericarditis around the heart. And then the person thinks they're having a heart attack because they've got heart pain. But yeah, these membranes are susceptible to cancers. They're also susceptible to infections and inflammation as well. That just looks like a roast to me. I don't know about you. Okay. Bottom of your page there, let's talk about some connective membranes, keeping in mind that these contain only what type of tissue?
Connective.
connective tissue.
Right.
And we know that connective tissues connect, protect, support. And it makes sense that we find these particular membranes in your movable joints. Hey, if you could remember one thing from our discussion on membranes, it would be to reduce friction. Mucus reduces friction. Serous fluid. I can talk today.
Yeah.
Serous fluid reduces friction. I don't even know what that word was. And then finally, synovial fluid also reduces friction. So, hey, that's easy to remember. One job hits all three of these kinds of fluids. They all reduce friction. You just got to remember where they do that job. I'm just checking to see if you still need the slide for your blanks. Good. Okay. I just wanted to show you a picture of a typical joint. This could be your knee or your elbow, shoulder, hip, for instance. Even your ankle joints or wrist joints look like this. What you've got is a bunch of stuff in here that helps to reduce friction. You've got articular cartilage that covers the outside of the bone. You also have a bunch of spongy bone at the end of the bone that reduces friction. And then in between those bones, we have a space where synovial fluid is housed. And that synovial fluid can cushion the blow between those two adjoining bones. Now, unfortunately, when people get arthritis, that synovial fluid isn't doing enough of a job, and the cartilage can become destroyed. And worse yet, they can have osteoarthritis, and then what becomes destroyed?
The
bone, yeah. So, unfortunately, arthritis is inflammation of the joint, and that can inflame the cartilages and the bone tissue. That's right, it's so swollen in there, yeah.
My grandma's got it bad. She gets it, like all of a sudden her hand, all she can't force the claws right up on this earth because it does that so bad.
She got a rheumatoid or just regular arthritis?
I believe she's got just a regular arthritis and all, but she's got it, like I said, so bad at all where she can't haul and move her hands for a short time.
Wow.
Wow.
And people who don't have arthritis, they can have a condition called bursitis. And that comes from having excess fluid around the joint. And too much fluid, like you're saying there, can cause the joint to basically seize up and not be able to move. So we'll talk more about articulations in Chapter 8. So we'll come back and revisit this whole joint structure one more time. Okay. Any questions on the membranes? Does this make pretty good sense? Okay, our next chapter is skin. It begins on page 54. This is a fun chapter. I think you'll enjoy this one. After having been through the heavy duty of tissues, this is a nice lightweight chapter. Well, I want to welcome you to your first organ system. Up to this point, we've been talking about the building blocks for an organ system. And now you finally reach, in week 6 of this class, our first organ system. So, yay! This one is the integumentary system, and you can see it's a very busy system. We oftentimes think of skin as being part of this system, but it's more than just skin. This system also includes accessory structures, like what?
Sweat glands.
Sweat glands. Oil glands.
Hair.
Good. Fingernails.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more to this system than just simply the epidermis and the underlying dermis. We also have accessory structures that we'll include in our conversation as well. All right, so let's talk about the two main layers of this system. This, of course, refers to the skin or the integument. The skin includes an outermost thinner epidermis and a deeper, thicker dermis. Your skin covers about 20 square feet of your body, making it the largest organ we have. And when we look at each other, what we see is primarily dead skin cells. your hair is also dead. So that's kind of a weird thing, that what we see when we look at each other is mostly dead stuff. What's that?
Fingernails too, right?
Yeah, fingernails too. Yeah, pretty much everything on the outside is dead stuff. Okay, so how do you keep straight that epidermis is the outermost layer and dermis is the deeper layer? Epi's upon or around, it's the outermost layer. I don't know about you, but when I was in like middle school back in the early 1900s, you know, kids would come around and say, I see your epidermis is showing today. And you're like, oh my God, what's wrong? Is my zipper down? What's up? But you know, then you finally learn that the epidermis is the outermost portion of your skin. You're like, oh, phew, okay, I'm not exposing myself today. That's great news. So yeah, epidermis is the outermost layer of your skin. Dermis is deeper and thicker layer of your skin. Hypodermis is actually not part of your skin. It's a connective piece between your skin and whatever's underneath, usually muscle or something else like cartilage. All right, so here we've got a great look at keratinized, stratified, squamous epithelial tissue and an underlying region of dermis, which is mostly dense, irregular, and loose areolar connective tissue. So you can't really tell from this picture that the epidermis is thinner, but let's see, I've got another one for you. This, you can really see the thinness of that outer epidermis and how much thicker that underlying dermis actually is. I wanted to show you this picture because I want you to get a feel for how the epidermis and the dermis groove together. They are not laying like layer cakes, one right on top of another, that are smooth and flat. They sit together more like an egg crate. You can see the grooved appearance here between the basement membrane of your stratified squamous and the topmost layer of your underlying connective tissue. So why is this an advantage for us? Keeps it attached, right. If you had two flat layers like a layer cake, it wouldn't take very much friction at all to do what?
Rub it off,
exactly. And if you've ever worn a tight shoe and had a blister form, you've experienced those two layers separating from each other. So we know that's really painful if you happen to rub those two regions apart. So yeah, this groovy egg crate appearance is to help keep those two layers connected together. So I'd like to talk to you about some types of cells that are common in your epidermis. Let me give you a moment to jot them down in your blanks. They're in the right order. Keratinocytes. And then melanocytes. And then Langerhans cells.
So if I say for keratinocytes, that's wrong?
I don't think so. People still know what you're talking about. Break the word roots down. We know that keratin is a what?
It's
waterproofing protein. Good. And the suffix site tells you what?
Cell.
Good. So mature cell. And then we've got melanocytes that produce.
Melanin.
Yeah, melanin protects you from UV radiation. And we'll hit those Langerhans cells in just a moment. The epidermis is mostly stratified squamous, filled with keratinocytes. That's the majority of our cell type here. And these keratinocytes make, guess what, keratin. And that keratin is going to dry out by the time you reach your uppermost layers. We know that all epithelial tissues are avascular. That means what? No blood vessels, yeah. So by the time you get up to the topmost layers, you've gotten so far away from a source of blood that those cells dry out and die. You have to be down near the bottommost layers of your epidermis to actually get any of the nutrients or oxygen that come from the blood that's sitting way down below in that dermis. So these cells up here near the top are simply dried out, wispy cells. That's all they are, is just keratin-filled dead cells. If you do like this and rub your arm, you're probably knocking off hundreds or thousands of dead keratinocytes. Most of the dust, this is gross, in your house is, guess what?
Dead
skin cells. Yeah, it's those keratinocytes. So, you know, if we could wear microscopic vision, we would look at each other and see hundreds of skin cells coming off all the time. We are constantly losing those dead skin cells. Let's see, melanocytes are next. They make melanin, and the function of melanin is to protect you from UV light. And where does that UV light come from?
The sun.
Good. So we know that based on genetics, we're going to produce a certain amount of melanin anyway, but sun exposure and UV radiation can increase melanin production by those melanocytes. Kind of cool the way they've dyed this picture. Look at the bottommost region of your epidermis. It shows up a different color. That's where your melanocytes are producing the melanin. As your skin ages over the next few weeks, that melanin will be pushed up to the topmost layers. And eventually, after about a month, this topmost region will be sloughed off as dead skin cells. So, I mentioned to you just a minute ago that most of our skin cells are keratinocytes. What happens is these melanocytes will break off little tiny arms inside the keratinocyte. So the melanin becomes trapped inside a keratin-filled cell. So together, the keratin and the melanin travel to the topmost portion of your skin. About a month later, that melanin and keratin is just sloughed off. So it's about 3 to 4 weeks' time that it takes for any sun-exposed skin to darken and then be removed by dead skin cells. So if you went outside today and stayed all afternoon in the bright sunlight, a month from now, those skin cells will be sloughed off and removed. That's about how long sun exposure is protecting your skin from melanin being deposited there. So another really cool picture there. These are all melanocytes with melanin-filled cells in that deepest layer of your epidermis. Just wanted to mention, in the sunlight, there's actually two kinds of radiation. You'll notice that UVA is ultraviolet A, and it penetrates through the epidermis and the dermis. So it's got a wavelength that can reach further into your skin. The UVB penetrates only through the epidermis only. So interesting to note that glass for your vehicle does not protect against UVA radiation unless you put some kind of darkening tint on your windows, okay? I want to show you what happens if you ride in a car for your livelihood. Just checking to see if y'all need the slide. This is what happens if you ride in a car with no tinting. Because we live in the northern hemisphere and a lot of our sunlight comes from the south, this man was driving, you know, sitting on the left side of the vehicle where he got sun exposure. Look at the big difference between the left side of his face with sun exposure and the right side. Yeah.
I thought it was just age catching up with
it. It looks almost like he's had a stroke on that one side, doesn't it? Yeah. So if this is not an advertisement, this is what those skincare companies should put out there and say, hey, use our sunscreen. This is the picture they should use, as somebody who's had sun exposure for 30 years. If he had used sunscreen, that could have reduced UVA reaching that dermis layer. Or if he had put tinted windows that block UVA radiation coming through, that could also help. But you know, if you drive a car that has no tinting and no sunscreen on, then you know, you're basically destroying the collagen that's in the deeper layers of your dermis. Yeah. All right, so these are Langerhans cells, and they're a type of white blood cell that patrols your epidermis. What are they after? Yeah, any microorganism that makes its way through your skin. We've got a pretty good barrier though, right? We've got keratin that blocks water from coming in. We have tight junctions in our epidermis. But you know, microbes can make their way through, and these Langerhans cells are gonna fight and eat those foreign invaders. So these are actually on the move. They can migrate throughout your skin. They're not just sitting in one place. So they're in motion going through your skin, eating up bacteria that comes through. You know, older people are more susceptible to infections of all kinds, skin infections included, and that's because their white blood cell population and Langerhans cells may be less active and eating up things that are invading the area. Any questions so far on keratinocytes, melanocytes, Langerhans cells? All right, so what region are we in? Epidermis or dermis?
Epidermis.
Epidermis, good. So these three cells help us be protected from something in the epidermis. What do keratinocytes protect us from?
Water.
And drying out, right? They protect us from gaining water, or more importantly, drying out. What do melanocytes protect us from?
UVA,
UVB radiation. And then finally, what do Langerhans protect us against?
Microorganisms
like bacteria. Good. So these three cells help protect us from something in our environment in the epidermis. Let me pause here and give y'all a moment to write down the five strata. There's blanks for you there in your worksheet. Did you all get the sign-in sheet today?
No.
Okay. I know a lot of you came to this class from Bio 110. You probably heard the trick, right?
That's what I was looking for. Come let's get sunburned.
Oh, I like that way.
Yeah,
that's
come let's get sunburned. That's it. Right. That's another one. Good. Corny Lucy's grandma spent billions. I have to add the come let's get sunburned. That was great. If you happen to want one from the bottoms up, it's better students give love and care. But you got to be careful whichever one you pick. You have to know that you're using one that's top to bottom or bottoms up.
Right.
Yeah. Why is there a star beside Lucidum?
Because it's only in the thicker
skin. Yeah, hands and feet are the only places that have that extra Lucidum layer. Is the outermost portion of our epidermis. It's dead skin cells, mostly keratinocytes. They've lost connection with any blood supply, so they are nothing but dried out dead wisps of skin, and that's it. You know, we're looking at maybe 15 or 30 layers of dead skin cells in that outermost corneum layer. There's a reason that we call corns and calluses what we do, because they come from excess keratinocytes built up in this stratum corneum layer. So when you are dry, or when you're sunburned, or when you're just losing cells, it is from that stratum corneum that we're going to be losing those dead skin cells. So do all parts of your skin, all over your body, have a stratum corneum?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm messing with you.
Yeah.
Everywhere has a corneum. That's right. Okay, the next layer down, you'll notice, is stratum what?
Lucidum.
Good. So this picture must have come from where?
A hand or a foot.
Good. So it's got a thicker layer. It's just a few skin cells, that's all. But the reason we call it lucidum is because it's lucid or clear. And it's kind of hard to tell in this picture, but they do have a more clear appearance than the underlying granulosum layer. Speaking of granulosum, that region includes granules, and you'll notice it appears to take on a darkness. What do you think these granules are containing?
Melanin.
Melanin, yep. So you'll notice that dark region there. That includes some melanin in stratum granulosum. As we come down into spinosum and basal, you'll notice the cell shape looks a little bit different. These are cells that are undergoing mitosis. That means they're doing what?
Splitting
and dividing. Cell division, right. So your living cells are down here near the basement membrane. These are the ones undergoing cell division. And by the time we reach up here towards, say, corneum, we're looking at nothing but dead cells. By the way, how long does it take for cells in stratum basal to become part of stratum corneum and be lost?
15 to 30 days.
Yeah, 15 to 30 days. Depending on how fast your skin is growing, it may be as long as 40 to 50 days. So, you know, sometimes depending on your metabolic rate, it may grow slower. But we're looking at about 2 to 4 weeks on average for the basal layer to reach your corneum layer and then be sloughed off as dead skin cells. So why do those cells near the apical surface die? Good. There's blood vessels not in the epidermis, but sitting where?
In the dermis,
right. Good. I also want to mention that there are desmosomes here. What are desmosomes? Desmo means band. Okay, so desmosomes band together different cells. So when you lose them as a sheet or a layer, they are still hooked together by their desmosomes. So down here in the spinosum and up there in the granulosum, we're starting to see them linked together using those desmosomes. Why do you think the cells in this bottommost region are a different color than the top ones? What do the bottommost ones contain? Why are the ones down here a different color than the ones near the top?
Because the ones down there don't have melanin like here.
These have melanin, and they're being pushed up and they're dying, which means they're drying out. That's why they're a different color. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Live it up for the 2 to 3 weeks that they got it. Kind of cool to see the basement membrane, which is actually a little layer right here beneath the lowest portion of stratum basal. It is easy to remember that basal sounds like basement, so that of course is the lowest layer of our epidermis. So active dividing living cells are in the basement membrane, and or rather actually stratum basal, and the dead cells are the ones that you get going up toward the topmost region. Okay. You got a tool to remember these, right? Come Let's Get Sunburned or Corny Lucy's Grandma Spent Bundles or Billions. Okay, and which of the five layers is only found in hands and feet, thicker skin?
Lucidum.
Good. All right. So now that you kind of know what you're looking for, you can look at a picture like this and say, okay, there's your basal layer. It's the groovy layer that's like egg crating with the neighboring tissue. This dark layer through here is stratum granulosum. And then on the other side, you're looking at lucidum and then a huge thick layer of stratum corneum. Because there is no blood supply directly traveling through your epidermis, if you were to scratch this area, you're not going to bleed. That's how we can shave and not kill, you know, basically bleed to death, right? Because you're not pulling down into the dermis where there's actually a blood supply. So anything you do to this epidermis layer should not produce bleeding. Okay?
My teacher was talking about something that they used to do a long time ago, maybe like with little kids, they would stick like a little safety pin or something in the epidermis for their skin, and then just walk around and all people be like, what in the world?
But there's no bleeding, so.
Yeah. Unless until you start getting nervous.
But That's right. So you pull through that dead stratum corneum out there, and very little pain from that too. Okay. So what a pretty picture. Up at the top, we have all of this is stratum corneum down to this point here. This clear looking layer is our stratum lucidum. What about the dark layer?
Granulosum.
And a lot of the stuff in here?
Spinosum.
And the actively dividing cells?
Basal.
Good. So you can kind of get a sense for those five layers in this skin. This is thick skin. It would be located where? Epidermis of the palms and the soles of your feet, right? Need a little extra thickness there. All right, so let's talk about skin colors. We're pretty much a bag of Skittles when it comes to skin colors. We go everything from red to blue to green, yellow, everything in between. So let's start with orange as a skin color. Orange is something that people naturally have in their skin if you come from an Asian background. Keratin is what gives our skin a yellowish-orange pigmentation. And so some people naturally produce keratin or beta-carotene. Others of us can actually gorge on beta-carotene-rich foods and give our skin an orange coloration. So carrots, of course, have a beta-carotene in there. What else? Squash.
Pumpkin.
Yeah, anything yellow, orange is a great source of beta carotene. And I know that sometimes little kids really get hooked on a food and that's all they want to eat. And if they eat nothing but carrots or sweet potatoes, they can turn their skin orange from the inside out. How long will this skin pigmentation last? A few weeks, yeah. At least a few weeks. So I've heard of parents taking their kids to the doctor's office thinking they're jaundiced, when in fact they've actually turned themselves orange-yellow from that carotene. Buyer beware, there are all sorts of ads on the internet for these quick tan peels, and if you take one of those quick tan peels, you're not going to tan, you're going to orange, right? So some of those peels are nothing but beta-carotene peels. Yeah. Canned fruit, maybe if it's peaches or something, I would read the label, but it would take a...
No, not canned fruit. Like, canned fruit also carry... Like,
oh,
carry
not canned fruit.
Yeah,
I gotcha. Fruit, maybe peaches because they're orange, lemons because they're yellow, oranges, but it would take a heck of a lot to get excess beta carotene that way. Probably diarrhea before you ever got to the point from all that fruit, yeah. So we've talked about melanin. We know it's also a skin pigmentation, and it protects us from what?
UV radiation.
Good. And this particular pigment has a brownish-black color to it, and of course that's meant to darken the underlying layers and protect the most important regions where cell division occurs. So we produce melanin in stratum basal. It raises up to the topmost layers, and that is meant to darken and protect stratum basal where we're seeing active cell division occur. Okay, so interesting stuff about melanin. It's going to protect you from having further skin damage. And if you do see a sign of tanning, it actually indicates that there's been skin damage occurring. Tanning actually means damage is happening. All right, let me take you on over to the top of page 55. So where is hemoglobin located? Good, red blood cell. And of course, because they're in a red blood cell, this particular pigment will make you appear red in color. So hemoglobin contains iron molecules. These iron molecules bind oxygen. And when the hemoglobin is oxygenated and it travels close to your skin surface, we take on a flushed red appearance. So if you are hot, if you're inflamed, if you're, say, sunburned and inflamed, you're going to take on a reddish color in your skin thanks to the hemoglobin traveling closer to the skin surface. If, however, the hemoglobin travels further away from your skin surface, guess what color you appear?
Blue.
Blue. Good.
So the term up there for red skin is called erythema. That just technically means reddish skin. And you're right, if you're blue, you're cyanotic.
Usually when it's blue, that's where something's dying.
It basically means lack of oxygen. And it could indicate that there's going to be tissue damage there if it's long term.
Like during like the winter time when it's snowing and all, like if somebody goes outside without gloves on their hand, they end up just as blue as the sky.
Yeah, and if that's the case, then they need to get warmth back in there, because otherwise those tissues could die. That'd be the next step, that frostbite. Yeah. So I wanted to mention that there is never. Are you turning blue? It is cold in here. I just want to mention that there's never ever a time where your blood is blue. It's actually a trick of the eye. What you see through your skin pigmentation is brown melanin, and the skin underneath carries blood that is deoxygenated. And that deoxygenated blood is a dark red color. I don't know how in the world your eye perceives brown and dark red as purplish blue, but it does. So there's never ever a true time for blue blood, but of course we perceive it as being a bluish purple color. So just wanted to make a connection here. You've been bruised, right? Mm-hmm. Bruises are blue, they're green, they're yellow. So if you've got a bruise that is blue or cyanotic, it just simply means that tissue is losing what?
Oxygen.
Yep. This is the only picture I could find of these three guys that are related. They live in Kentucky. They have a genetic condition called methemoglobinemia. God, that's a name, isn't it?
Yeah.
What is that, like six syllables? Seriously. I don't know if you can tell, but the guy on the far right has a blue tint to his face. And so this comes from Mary and your cousin?
Yep. No.
Yep.
Yeah.
For real?
Yeah.
Generation after generation after generation. Yeah.
They say that if you don't have no genetic diversity, you know, that's what causes those genetics.
Exactly right. Yep. So it's not just a one-off incident of Mary and somebody close related. This is generations of it. And so it's a genetic condition that comes about from that kind of breeding. And this... incest, yeah, and so this is actually a blue skin tone that has nothing to do with loss of oxygen. Yeah. Yep, crazy stuff.
Oh my God.
And this is silver nitrate poisoning. There's a man that I understand lives in the Darlington area that has this.
Oh,
who? Don't know.
You know that color.
Mm-hmm.
This
Darlington, yeah.
Crazy.
Wow. This man took. Yeah, he's purple. Yeah,
purple.
This is not him.
Oh, no.
Some people take it because it's like a health tonic, but in small amounts it's okay. But in larger amounts it can do this to you. From what I understand, it's a liquid potion. Not like a. I mean, it's something you can get, I guess, from health stores, but. In excess, it can turn you this color, and it's irreversible.
You're the same as the amalgam, like silver filling?
Not necessarily that. This is a liquid, and you drink
but
it.
You know, this is the same color that stains your gum, like the amalgam filling.
Yes, you're
it's
right.
Amalgam tattoo.
You're right.
I mean, it looks just like this.
Wow. It may, in fact, and maybe in small doses, it's okay. Yeah.
Irreversible.
Irreversible.
Oh my God.
And
seriously.
Looks like he got
a bad
case
of
sunburn. I know. Or it looks like he's painted for a ball game.
Yeah,
you know?
Really purple.
This guy actually passed away in the past few years. He had a heart attack, totally unrelated to the condition that he has with the silver nitrate poisoning. But, yeah, you know, there's health tonics and whatnot that, you know, are over the counter that advertise making you feel better. Just beware, right? He was white to begin with. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh yeah, really? I don't know that they would do anything there.
Yeah.
It's probably at your own risk. I cannot remember what it was for.
But I think it's like for like I'm not sure if it's bacterial infections or what it is. I'll have to look. All right, so jaundice is yellowing. What organ does this point the finger at?
The liver.
Yeah, and there's also the gallbladder, which can store bile. But yeah, we often look at the liver and or gallbladder because if bile backs up into your bloodstream and then bile breaks down, of course, it's got a yellow tone to it, and that can pigment your skin yellow.
So what does the bile blockage inside your eye?
Actually, it's a bile blockage in your liver, and instead of being secreted into your digestive tract, the bile gets in your bloodstream. And it should not be. It's all over your entire body. Yeah.
I had a family member that had sickle cell anemia.
Yeah.
She had it because of that. I guess it damaged her liver or something.
Yeah. Ouch.
Yeah, just that pill of
it. That's quite yellow.
Yeah.
Some babies are born with jaundice, and that's because they haven't had their first bowel movement, and the bile is backing up into their bloodstream. Once they have their first poop, then the bile blockage should be removed and this should go away. The really cool thing about jaundice is the sunlight can break it down. So they have little lamps for babies born with jaundice that you can sit the baby under. It will destroy this pigmentation in the skin and restore their normal pigment coloring. Otherwise, you can put them out in the sun like a plant and that can help to break down the jaundicing. I think they probably prefer the lamp, right? Because you don't want to burn the brand new baby. I sunburned my baby. This guy here is JFK, president back in the early 1960s. It is believed he had a condition called Addison's disease, which is an adrenal gland disorder that produces bronzing of the skin. So if you know someone who is seeing pigment changes and they're not sun exposed, like this lady and her gums, then that's a warning sign for an adrenal gland issue. We'll talk more about that when we get into Bio 211.
Oh my God.
See those pigment issues?
It looks like gums.
And sometimes this can be melanoma. There's actually cases where melanoma can do this, but these skin pigmentation changes are warning signs for adrenal gland issues. Because I don't think anybody goes outside to sun their gums, right? Maybe your buns, but not your gums. Okay, this is vitiligo. This is a problem with melanocytes failing to produce melanin. In the patches of skin where he's lost all melanin production, what is he at a higher risk for?
Sun damage, sunburn, skin cancer.
This guy is actually a newscaster, and he's very open about putting on makeup. He wants people to learn about his condition, so he puts on makeup and he explains, you know, why he's doing it to be a newscaster. Unfortunately, this is a progressive disorder, so it will only continue to get worse for him.
So eventually,
he'll completely go patchy. Yeah, he may have splotches and patches all over.
It's like
he's becoming that, yeah. This is Michael Jackson's disease, by the way, and what we think he did was shut down melanin production using a hormone. You can cut off, there's actually a hormone produced by your brain, and you can shut off that hormone producing melanin and blanch yourself white all over. So that must have been what Michael Jackson did. But yeah, they can give B12 to help slow the progressive effects of this, but they don't really fully understand why it happens. Less terrible than vitiligo is freckles. That comes from sun exposure. It also is a genetic condition. You know, if it's sun exposure, then later in life it can lead to these things called liver spots. And so that's why sun exposure earlier in life can cause skin damage that only appears later in life. And then finally, albinism is a genetic condition. You can have two parents with normal pigmentation produce a child who has no pigmentation. It affects hair, skin, and eyes. Yeah. So you may have heard of stories in Africa. There are some people that think that an albino carries special gifts, and so they kill the albinos in their neighborhoods. So the people that are albinos actually have to hide and stay away from public view. So So pretty awful misconception there of what albinism actually is.
They can't stay in the sun.
They cannot stay in the sun, yeah. They can get an eye cancer and, of course, skin cancer from this condition. All right, so let's see. We're about halfway down page 55. Let's take a look at the dermis. This is a great picture for showing us the thin epidermis and the deeper dermis. The dermis is the blood vessel-rich, nerve-enriched layer of our skin. It actually includes two regions, an upper papillary layer and a deeper reticular layer. Hey, notice they're alphabetical, right? P comes before R. That helps you keep them straight. So all of this stuff up top in blue on this picture is all epidermis. In fact, all of the very most top region is stratum what?
Corneum,
good. The dark region that comes through and divides that?
Granulosum,
and then spinosum, and then the deepest layer?
Basal,
right. And you'll notice that the epidermis grooves with your underlying dermis. That's to keep the layers stuck together. And these pieces of the dermis that poke up into your epidermis are called dermal papillae or papillae. And so you can see some of them sticking up there. Those are important because they help to create fingerprints and footprints. You can see some of them sticking up here. Okay. Yeah, fingerprints and footprints. So we actually have that grooviness all over our entire bodies, but we only see it showing up in those particular regions, hands and feet. So on your worksheet there, you'll notice that the papillary layer creates what's called an epidermal ridge. And that's what you see on the surface of your hands and your feet. You see those ridges created by the dermal papillae down below. Everybody's different, yeah. They say it's genetically driven, and there's even been some research that says that when you're in womb, that touching the inside of the womb changes the orientation of the shapes, but, I mean, we know it is somewhat genetically driven. All right, so you'll notice that the dermis in the papillary layer includes sensory nerves. We have blood vessels here. That is important because what does the epidermis have? Does it have blood vessels?
No.
No, so it's important to appreciate that, hey, finally, we've got blood. You know, we've got an ability to nourish this tissue, and the blood traveling through your dermal papillae have to nourish the under regions of your epidermis. That's the only way we can get blood up there into that epidermis. So if your dermis grows too quickly, you can form problems like this. You know, let's go back and think about this picture for just a moment. What types of tissue form the dermis? Loose areolar and dense irregular. Yeah, and both of those are not really going to heal quickly, especially that dense irregular connective tissue. So if you happen to grow quickly or gain weight quickly, then you can end up getting those tears in your dermis known as stretch marks. So in this picture, you might be able to see that this topmost portion is loose areolar, and then starting right through the reticular layer is where you find that dense, irregular connective tissue. All right, so going back and thinking about what we discussed with tissues on Monday, what kinds of fibers are common to dense, irregular, and loose areolar?
Collagen,
yeah. So we got a lot of collagen down there. Collagen loses its strength over age, and so that's why skin sags as we get older. It's also the reason for wrinkles. So collagen, if damaged by sunlight, accelerates its aging process. So let's talk about some of those disorders. Here we have stretch marks or tears in the dermis. You know, a lot of medications advertise themselves as getting rid of your stretch marks. Nope. Yeah. All you can do is make the shiny appearance go away, but that tear is always going to exist down there in the dermis. So if you gain weight quickly, if you're pregnant, whatever the case, you know, that stretch mark is yours to keep. It's your consolation prize, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God.
These are blisters, yeah, from a henna tattoo. Somebody had a reaction to the pigment in that tattoo ingredient. So blisters are actually an accumulation of fluids in between what?
The dermis and the epidermis.
Dermis and the epidermis, that's right. And we've all heard, don't pop the blister, right?
Like, it's pretty. Yeah,
it is pretty. Yeah. But it hurts like heck.
Yeah.
It's what?
It had the breast on its own.
I don't know that I would possibly, yeah, let it do it on its own, or possibly keep it bandaged and covered so it doesn't get infected. Yeah. So if you were to pop these blisters, I mean, first of all, ouch. But second of all, if you introduce bacteria into the blister, it now can meet blood vessels in your dermis. Yeah. Don't pop them, yeah. The last thing on this page is a really cool concept. These are called the lines of cleavage, not the ones you're thinking of. Okay. So these lines of cleavage are actually the collagen fibers in your dermis and the direction they run. So kind of cool thing to look at here. Let's talk about C-sections for moms giving birth. C-sections are often given kind of like as a bikini cut. And if you notice the lines of cleavage, they don't run like that. They run like a V. So if you cut across the lines of cleavage, what does that mean for your heel time?
Be longer.
Be longer, yeah. Ideally, if you're cut through surgery, what do you want them to do in respect to your lines of cleavage?
Cut along the lines.
Cut along the lines, exactly.
Can they do that?
If they can, they could do it that way, but I'm not sure for a C-section they could, which is probably why it's painful.
Listen, can y'all follow the line of cleavage?
As you're being, yeah.
Yeah, for my feedback.
Yeah.
So those are our nerves run also?
Some of the nerves in the chest area run that way, and in the leg area some of them do, but a lot of them don't. But yeah, if they're cutting through a line of cleavage and a nerve, then yeah, you've got, got problems, yeah. Well, some of them are cutaneous, you know, some of them serve the skin, so they may, if they damage one. If you want to see your own lines of cleavage, if you look in your hands, you'll notice that there are some lines running down your fingers, and those are lines of cleavage. That's actually the collagen fibers in your dermis and the directions that they run. So I'm not talking fingerprints here, I'm just talking the lines that run the length of your fingers.
On the sides of them, there's some that run horizontal.
Yeah, like kind of where your finger bends.
And that's thin as well.
Mm-hmm. Last little bit for today is top of page 56. Hypodermis is not part of your skin, but I'll mention it here anyway. It's mostly fatty connective tissue that separates skin from underlying muscle tissue. And this is the region where we give hypodermic injections. This is a greatly vascularized tissue, meaning what?
It has a lot of nerves.
A lot of blood vessels. Yeah, a lot of blood vessels. So if you want to hit a blood supply, this is a great place to give that injection. Tattoos should not go here because this area can gain weight and can lose weight. So if you're giving a tattoo, not a henna tattoo, where should you give the injection?
Dermis,
yeah. Why give the tattoo into the dermis?
I just thought the epidermis coming off, so you don't
want to. Yeah. You have 30 days for this tattoo.
All that money just
put it. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, if you give an actual tattoo with the needle, that should go into the dermis, not epidermis and not hypodermis, because both of those can be, you know, lost and change shape. That would, yeah, that'd be pretty deep too. So this looks like a good place to call it a day. We'll pick up with 57 on Monday. Y'all have a great weekend.